Ladies and gentlemen, it's a real pleasure, but it's also a challenge at the end of 2 days of actually foresight to start talking about foresight. Because in fact, we have done a lot of implicit foresight with extremely enthusiastic making presentations in some of the sessions. I must say that in particular, those sessions in which we had the young scientists speaking, you had perspectives in the long-term future. And so one of the lessons that is not in this presentation, but that is important, is that in foresight exercises, it's extremely important to involve the next generation. I will address an exercise that was undertaken by, or that is actually being undertaken, because we're talking about work in progress, by ICSU to develop its long-term strategic plan, but really also in an exercise that was set up to assist organizations that have similar problems of trying to find their way in an uncertain future and to put some rigor and structure in that process. I will talk a little bit about why foresight. We have chosen to use a scenario approach to foresight, and I'll explain that, and then I will explain the steps we took in the ICSU context, but more generally, these would be typical steps that one would take in such an exercise. Why foresight? Well, we have seen over the past two days, if we didn't already know, but we're in a fast-changing world at the moment, with a lot of uncertainties associated. And as Carthage said, the focus of this exercise has been 2031, which happens to be the 100th birthday of ICSU, but that was just the occasion. But the reason is that by focusing on a very long-term perspective, one might have better visibility of the steps that one might have to take in between in order to steer course. Why such a long-term perspective? Well, for one, the grand challenges that we've been hearing about have a very long-term character and have a very large scale, and that means that the associated planning and decision processes require long timelines. I just remind you that in the typical satellite experiments, the timeline is already more than 10 years, and for large facilities, similar periods apply. But also because new scientific developments, be it in climate, be it in health, require an unprecedented international collaboration, which means that it is a complicated process in itself with long timelines. There are changes and uncertainties associated with the emerging scientific powers in the world and the increasing global interdependence. These drivers create uncertainty around both the organization and the conduct of science. It also creates uncertainties around the skills and the infrastructures needed to do this science, but also the ends to which this science is directed. Organizations that have a role to play in this complex changing field must need to be better prepared. And typically, these organizations are not well prepared for that. Why? Well, they're small usually, there's a short-term agenda, budgets, the immediate needs that dominate the agenda. Very often there's only a partial view of what is happening, the major drivers of change, and the possible effects it might have on the organization. And what is necessary to address the full complexity is a system view of what is happening, and also that very often is lacking. What is the benefit that foresight brings in this process? Well, actually, a number of things. One is that it introduces long-term perspectives. We're trying to imagine what the world would be like in 2030. Not, and I will emphasize that later on again, not with the purpose of predicting what it's going to be, because then we might better go and have a drink and we might have better predictions. It is actually to get a better anticipation of what might happen, and as a result develop strategies that are slightly more robust than by just following practice as usual. It's also a way of exploring different possible futures and see what the consequences of these different futures might be for the actions of the organization. It combines knowledge from very different sources in order to develop new insights. What is very important is that foresight really is a learning process. It's not something done by a consultancy company and then in the form of a report put on the table. It's a process, and the process in fact is maybe as important or maybe even more important than the outcome of this process. Especially at doing such an exercise at the global level is very complicated if you want to make it a process that involves people. So you have to think carefully about the design. And I'm not going to say at the end of this presentation that we did the perfect thing. We also learned some lessons in this process. And what is important is that a foresight is oriented towards decisions that have to be made today, that is strategic decisions. And I'll come back to what that means for the design of the process as well. You might ask, foresight has been around for quite a while now, has it helped? Well, yes and no. It has certainly helped in the articulation of visions about the future, because it actually forces people to think about what is going to happen, in our case, in 20 years' time. It has definitely helped in the identification of priorities and milestones on the shorter timescales. If the process is conducted in the proper way, it helps in constructing advocacy coalitions to actually bring about the changes. If it's done well, it might help raising awareness of science. And what is important for the organizations that conduct such exercises, if it's done properly, it catalyzes a more forward-looking and flexible orientation of organizations. There are limits to foresight. As I said, it's not a mechanism to predict the future. It also doesn't replace existing decision-making and strategic approaches. It's a support mechanism that then needs to be dealt with, handled in an intelligent manner. It's not always easy, especially in a process involving many different actors, to make sense of what comes in terms of inputs and information. There is a risk in such a process that certain special interests hijack the process. And that is what is important. There has to be a commitment at the top level that this foresight is necessary, because otherwise you run the risk it's not going to be used and you do just a paper exercise. ICSU set about a consultative process to look at 2030. It's not aimed at identifying new emerging topics. First of all, ICSU has done this already, and many organizations around the world are doing that, and usually you get sort of the same topics emerging from that. The focus was on what does international collaboration in science require by 2013 in order to work. The starting point was describing the present landscape for international science, but we skipped that because at the same time we decided to do this, the Royal Society had decided to do exactly this with a forward-looking character included as well. And we benefited from those results. Identifying the drivers that actually are relevant for international science. And using these drivers, we developed a number of exploratory scenarios. That provided the context for a success scenario that within ICSU was developed to decide what ICSU would like the world to be in 2030 and how it could possibly contribute to making that world happen. What is important for this talk is not so much a discussion about the success scenario and about and even less so about the actions of ICSU, but to see how such a success scenario needs to be looked at in the context of these different possible future worlds. ICSU has used its extensive networks, both interdisciplinary, and its geographic networks. It has used its researchers that are associated with the organization and the institutions and networks. And as I said, ICSU has the experience of a foresight in 2002 on emerging issues in science, and a very recent one, a visioning process about Earth system science research. Why a scenario approach and not Delphi or desk studies or whatever? Well, a scenario approach gives you a tool for ordering perceptions about alternative future environments in which decisions are played out. So you are sketching a wider perspective. It also provides storylines to stimulate creative thinking on future actions. And this sketching of different worlds does not exclude that wild cards will throw over the whole thing. Wild cards are not part of the scenario building. They come in, they can be brought in, but then actually determine need to be looked at in the context of the various scenarios. What factors influence international science? Well, there are two categories. On the one hand, there are the megatrends. These are the big developments that actually force the world in a certain direction. They are well known. The direction is well known, although there's considerable uncertainty associated with the size of the impacts. And there are key drivers, factors whose direction of development is much less certain. The megatrends, demography, obvious. Natural resource availability. Of course, natural resources will play an increasing role in the discussions about our future. Global environmental change. I'm not saying with these that we know exactly what's going to happen, but that there will be major change is a certainty, and we need to anticipate that. Human health and well-being. Technological change will make major changes in our future world, and the enabling information technologies as well. And they will also influence in a very major way the way science is being conducted, as we have heard. This creates a general context, and there are many authoritative reports that describe the evolution of these megatrends in the coming, let's say, 10 to 30 years. Then there are key drivers, and the way we collected these key drivers was by asking the community, the ICSU community in this case, to identify what they see as major factors driving society and science in the relation to scientific development requiring international collaboration. From about something like 80 or 90 people from 30 countries, we received about 200 suggestions for drivers. And in the process of bringing them together, comparing, we selected in the end 12 drivers that we felt are of major importance. I'm not going to go through each of them. It's important in the utilization of the foresight process to do go into much more depth regarding each of these drivers, because the uncertainties associated, it's very important to be aware of the measure of uncertainties in developing policies. The two major drivers we identified are state sovereignty, regionalism, globalism, and science and society. In fact, the first one being, what is the evolution, the future evolution of society? Are we moving towards a really globalized world in which there is cooperation, or are we moving towards a world in which there is a renewed nationalism? And both of these worlds are rather different in their implications for international science. Science and society, will science and society live in harmony? Will the scientific community relate to society? Or will there be a divide between the scientific community and society? Also, that is a driver that will have profound influences on the way international science is conducted. And then there are a variety of drivers dealing with developments in society, such as the way states and markets will evolve. Will we have a sustainable society, sustainable economy, or will the free-for-all prevail in the end? There will be issues within science itself, science integrity, very important for the public acceptance of the results, but also for the progress of science itself. So each of these can go in different ways, and a measure of uncertainty is associated. Taking state sovereignty and science and society as the main axes, we developed, and this selection was made on the basis of the fact that these were influential drivers. They had a plausibly large range of uncertainty. They are reasonably orthogonal to each other, independent, and they generated in testing exercises interesting scenario spaces. This led to four scenarios. Scenario one, triumph of globalism, in which we have a globalized world and an engaged science, a science community and a science world committed to society. The second scenario is science supplying national needs, in which the states have a very nationalistic perspective, whilst the scientific community is internationally oriented. Then the third scenario is a scenario in which we have a global perspective of states, and science is actually, pulling back into the ivory tower. Science for sale in a global marketplace. And then the fourth scenario is a nationalistic world in which science has gone back to the ivory tower. These four scenarios are characterized and with a storyline. So this is not a description of a real world, but it is a world that is not impossible. And it will be characterized by things, in this case, that global governance in a globalized world will have received new lifeblood. There will be strategic research on societally important issues globally coordinated. There will be more interdisciplinarity because the problems that are addressed are interdisciplinary. But that will go at the expense of disciplinary research. And there will be an integration of the natural and social sciences. Scientific community is engaged with society in giving advice, in assessments, etc. There will be global networks of probably very often decentralized research facilities to conduct the necessary research. All of this will have as a consequence an increased external regulation of science in order to make it all happen. And most likely, there will be less curiosity-driven research opportunities. A greater mobility of scientists in a globalized world. And we state here there will be a single strong organization representing the independent voice of global science. That is the global world. A national and engaged with society world science supplying national needs. There will be a disenchantment in this world with international collaboration as a result of global economic crisis. There will be a focus on self-sufficiency and a focus on local sustainability. As a result, there will be different national science strategies rather than a global one. Government policy will regulate the priorities and the organization of science, and national needs dominate. Public-private partnerships will be necessary in such a more nationalistic situation, and they will exist. There will be most likely less curiosity-driven research opportunities, but although there are no global, there will be focus, there will be strong regional alliances. The developing countries will be dependent on the goodwill of the developed nations, and that will be a danger. And science is socially embedded in society. The science for sale in a global marketplace scenario, in which the nations have a global perspective, but science is detached from society, there we expect that the multinational companies, in fact, drive a fast globalization. Countries will have increasingly specialized in supplying only certain projects to the global markets, and by doing so become more dependent on a global system. Countries will have specialized. Converging technology and medical sciences will be the new frontiers of science. And science has gained independence through new breakthroughs and more curiosity-driven research. There will be a detachment from society, and the public trust in science declines as a result of the detachment of the scientific community. And science informs policies, but decisions are not driven by science, and the global governance structures are dominated by business. At the same time, there will be more global universities. The rise of aggressive nationalism, strong competition between nations, and a power struggle for global leadership. This scenario has the greatest potential for conflict and for harmful use of knowledge. There will be a culture of secrecy and, as a result, parallel research efforts. The trust in international assessments and predictions will have eroded. There will be strong nodes of national science, and the less developed countries will be isolated. And there's a decline in researcher mobility and a growing education divide. And a possibility is that national languages are promoted for scientific communication. The international governance of science might be dominated by economic powers. This is a spectrum of worlds in which organizations will have to chart their way. And ICSU has done so by thinking of a success scenario. What is the world we would like to see, and how are we going to realize it? Well, the success scenario is actually to imagine what the international science landscape would look like if it was best serving the needs of the nations. What would ICSU need to do? And the scenario approach was to test the plausibility and robustness of the actions. success scenario is probably something that this conference could easily subscribe to. Science is thriving. It's responding to societal challenges. It's making a valued contribution to policymaking. There are new mechanisms for planning international science and for funding the coordination. There's scientific integrity, and there's public appreciation and engagement as important mechanisms to give science credibility. In order to make that happen, a number of actions are necessary. And as I said, I'm not going through these here, but what I'm going to say is that what we need to do, and this is what we're currently doing, is look at each of these actions and chart them against the four different scenario spaces and see what we need to do to take a leading role in planning and coordination of research. Is a lot easier in a globalized world with an international orientation of the scientific community than in a nationalistic world. And in this way, we need to go through each of these actions and create a robust set of actions. And that is actually what we hope to achieve with this scenario exercise, that is to provide an agenda, to provide a mechanism with which, in this case, ICSU, but hopefully also others, can develop a strategy that is more robust than otherwise would be possible. Thank you.